is proof of God's existence. This is a problem that comes up whenever you speak to people who are intellectually curious. Proof of God's existence, proof of Termina Shemaim. You have number three, understanding seeming contradictions between science and Torah. Again, a very, very common problem. The fourth is, what is tefillah? Now, what I imagine what that's what the problem that comes up is usually, how does tefillah help? How does it fit in the whole relationship between Hashem and the human being? I mean, how can we affect Hashem's decision? Probably that's what is the main problem. Now, number five, free choice and destiny. We already discussed that. We already discussed number six, the importance of Talmud Torah for its own sake, the idea of the, remember we spoke about the two million. Number seven, why do we need so many mitzvos? Okay, let me discuss that part with somebody. Women's role in Judaism, that we'll discuss it some other time. What is the essential difference between a Jew and a Goy? Major problem. We have a basic sense of fairness, which is very strongly affected by our sense of difference. There is a difference, but how can there be a difference? It's unfair. And the number 10, the topic is, what is Eilu Ve'ilu Divrei Elokim Chayim? Why are there machlokas in halachas? If anybody else has any other ideas, yeah?
Dealing with music as kedusha, or how to deal with the physical world and not take a step from a spiritual world. Like, how do we explain that to them?
What do you mean? How do we explain to them the idea of kedusha?
Yeah.
What do you mean? The idea of to be mekadesh the physical.
Right. Exactly.
To be mekadesh the physical. Okay, I'll add it as part of the topics, the idea of to be mekadesh the physical. What does it mean exactly? Okay.
Covering that also, the concept of
tumah and tyra. Mm-hmm. Like in this parsha, like what is tumah. The concept of tumah and tyra? Okay. Any other
state
of Israel, a major. Major problem. Okay.
There's a lot of people.
Right?
Some people ask, what is the purpose of you being here?
Some the purpose, you mean human beings in the world, Jews in the world, or just as a connection? Okay, that is part of the subject of Jews and Goyim. I mean, if we know the idea of purpose, then we know the difference between Jews and Goyim. You're right. Okay, let's. Okay. Any other. Yeah.
I don't know, and I was once asked to explain what Kabbalah is.
Oh, what do you mean, the overall life? Well, it's a difficult, I mean, there is a tremendous desire of understanding Kabbalah. I mean, it's a problem. It's a really a problematic subject. Anything else? So let's start from the beginning. We have here the problem. How do we approach the question? Prove to me that there is a God. I mean, that's a question that goes all the way back to Chazal. You know, we find already in the Midrashim they talk about the idea, if you see something, the classical approach, if you see something planned, well, obviously there is a planner. Right? The famous example of a beautiful painting or a letter written, and someone says, the inkwell spilled, and this is how it came out into the beautiful painting or the beautiful poem, whatever you however you want to describe it. Right? That is the classical approach. There must be someone who planned everything which exists. Now, but you have to realize the problem of proof. Besides mathematics, outside of mathematics, yeah. Usually, people who actually want to be convinced, they just don't see the logic of believing in God. Right? We are not talking about committed atheists. Usually, you won't get the question from committed atheists. You'll get the question from people who just want to know, just prove it to me. I don't know how you say God, but prove it. Can you prove it to me? Can you prove to me the existence of God? people out of curiosity. They ask you to prove to them that there is
a... one of the top subjects on their list of priorities in life.
Again?
It's not one of their highest priorities. It's just interesting.
Right, it's a curiosity. That's the truth of the matter is that we might think that that is a... That's part of what I wanted to tell you. We might think that that makes the difference. If you can convince them that there is a God, that's it. That it really, really bothers them. From experience, I want to tell you that very, very few people are really bothered by it. As something that really bothers them, it doesn't bother them. But very often you have to explain something, give it a logical expression, even something that doesn't bother them, because when a person commits himself to Yiddishkeit, to Torah, it's not really a logical decision. This is the conclusion after dealing with perhaps thousands of people who are on their way of becoming Baal Tshuva. I'm convinced now that I've never convinced anyone of accepting Yiddishkeit. The most I can say that I succeeded is by little overcoming the barriers. In other words, when the basic need or tendency is with the person, all of a sudden there, let's call it the Yetzer Hara, builds up barriers. But how can you really believe in that? Because after all, how do you know that there is a God? Which means, usually, it's not that my conviction, my convincing them that there is a God is what's going to convince them to become frum. Their basic drive to become frum is within them, and it came obviously from the depth of their neshama. We had nothing to do with it. You sense that it's something that stems from within them. But their Yetzer Hara builds up resistance to that natural drive, to what the Nitzritzis, the Holy God, sparks are driving towards. And that Yetzer Hara takes certain shapes and forms. One of the shapes and forms that it takes is questions. Okay? So in that, we can be helpful. What I'm saying then is that you can never convince anybody of anything, because it's not exact logic. It's not like mathematics. I can convince you that 2 and 2 is 4, but I can't convince you of inexact logic. There is always a way out. What I can help you with is to remove the barriers in that drive of the person to become frum. So what I'm trying to do to him is not really to convince him that there is a God, but allow him to remove the doubt as a barrier in his path towards frumkeit, towards Yiddishkeit. Okay? So don't be surprised at all that you speak to a group or you speak to two people and you tell them exactly the same logic. The same proof, like you tell them this proof. What do you mean? Look around you. You see a world where everything fits in. It's so perfect. And to one person, that is an overwhelming proof. And to the other person, they'll say, Father, that's ridiculous. What do you mean? So it happened to have worked this way, because if it could be any other way, we wouldn't have a world. Because you know that there is a counter-argument. The counter-argument against this proof, that obviously there must be a planner, because the world is too planned, there's a very easy counter-argument. The counter-argument is, fine, it's a world that somehow works, right? What are the chances of such a world being created by chance? 1 in a trillion, right? 1 in 10 trillion. Fine, so we are the result of that chance. You hear the counter-argument? It's a very easy counter-argument. Which means that we have no proof at all. In other words, it's the same thing as saying, if you buy a lottery ticket, what are the chances that you are going to win? 1 in 2 million. So what are the chances you're going to win? Minimal. But what about for the person who already won? You say, I won, but it's impossible. It's only 1 in 2 million. But someone wins, right? So you are the one that won. So we are the world which worked out according to the law of statistics. Maybe it was tried 10 trillion times, and we are the 10 trillionth. Yeah?
My answer to that is that the American jelly does not run his life on such a low probability. So why over here we choose?
No. It's more than that. You see, because we are the result of that 1 in a trillion chance.
If you choose to view it as why you take that chance, that side of the argument as opposed to the other side. His whole life he runs with more probability.
We are coming to that. You mean to say, so at least let there be a doubt? That's what bothers you? Let at least be a sofek hashoko? That's what you mean? But you realize that a proof you don't have anymore.
Yes,
you see, you don't have a proof anymore. I was going to talk about it a little bit later. Since you bring it up, yeah.
What type of people generally give this counter?
Oh, usually the above average in intelligence. The above average in intelligence will always come up with this counter. What?
Yeah, I know.
Do you have a theory why the above average
is
intellectual
anti-intellectual? Well, because, I mean, it's a, you know, the one who is above average. What?
It's anti-intellectual.
Oh, no, just the opposite. It's very intellectual.
No, it's much more intellectual to assume there's a planet. I mean, that's...
That's the intuition. It's just the opposite. Usually you have the intuitive type accepting this argument. And the purely logical type, the one who is probably like who is working on his master's in physics or in mathematics, will not accept this argument. Just the opposite. It's the purely intellectual who will not accept the argument. As a rule, I mean, it's America, but as a rule, he will not accept it. It's the intuitive, right? That the one who is involved in the social sciences or in philosophy, right? Sometimes, well, philosophy so-and-so, but so-so, but those, the intuitive types, the ones involved in literature, right? Those are the ones who will hear it, who will sense it. Yeah, you are right. I mean, things are too perfect. I mean, things fit in too well. Right? Just the opposite. It's the purely intellectual who will reject the argument. He won't go for it. But there is another argument, and that's what, yeah.
Another argument that I've had some people is that it's not so perfect.
That's what?
That it's not so perfect.
That the world is not so perfect.
You have various ecological problems that are going on now, and if it was so perfect, then it would have made a world that we could have given class without pollution.
It's man-made, Parker. I mean, the point is, it is perfect. Like, you know, scientists have a way of thinking, you know, that there is, for instance, a Victor Miller. Did you ever see the books, a Victor Miller's books? He has some of the examples, how the fruits, because of the skin, can survive. If there would be if the skin would be too thick, it would rot. It would be too thin, the sun would destroy it. It has to be just exactly so in order for it to survive. Meaning, everything has to be just exactly so in order to survive. Too many things are just exactly so. In other words, if the distance between the sun and the earth would be like a few 100,000 miles more or less, we couldn't survive. We would either freeze or being burned down. I mean, if the atmosphere wouldn't be exactly so, we couldn't survive. There are too many things which are exactly so, or else we wouldn't be able to survive. And that is, again, I mean, you can say each specific thing, you know, that each argument is not acceptable, but all in all, you do get the feeling that too many things are just so exact that there needs to be a planner. Or, like the counter-argument says, because one world did survive out of the 10 trillion worlds which were tried before, so of course everything has to fit in, because otherwise it wouldn't have survived. Since we are the only surviving world, so we are the one in the 10 trillion, so therefore it's just by chance that it happened. Okay?
What does it mean if they were tried before?
Lavdak, I'm just using it as a figure of speech. It's not a meaning. When you throw dice, and you are looking for the number one, right? It, sometimes it can come out on the first try, sometimes it will come out on the sixth try, or sometimes it comes out on the tenth try. But it's just theoretically possible, right, that we are just the world at work. Now, by chance, all kinds of combinations of atoms happen in the world, right? And right away it was done, it was made and destroyed, like Boine Oilomoisu Machribon Soro, meaning it's created and destroyed because it just doesn't work out until finally one world really works.
I think the Rishani mentioned this, or many of the Rishani reports mentioned this proof. Why is there so much variation and rebreed in this world, which did develop as it did, let's say, through, it doesn't have to be, in other words, everything was put together. You could take apart, let's say, we'll get rid of all the flies, or we'll get rid of all the grass, or all the weeds, or something else. There could have been a lot less variety in the world. But we do see that so much variety, and it all runs according to the same rules.
Yeah, what does that prove? A planner or natural development? Right?
Well,
you have Darwin's theory, which tells you
natural development. Yes,
yeah, I understand, but that's part of the thing, which means the variations is just part of the natural development. I mean, if you want to counter argue. I mean, you have the Darwin's theory of, that eventually all combinations will happen and only the fittest will survive. And then other trillion combinations will happen and again only the fittest will survive. You have that counter-argument.
Isn't it true that there can't be a proof 100%?
Exactly. That's the point. The point. Exactly. It can be. It can by its very essence, it can be. Because the moment it's a proof like 2 and 2 is 4, right? Then again, there is no choice anymore. There has to be room for emuna. There has to be room for choice. But there's something else. There's a counter argument here. There's a siddur there. Can you pass me the siddur? I saw it as a pshat in Pirkei Avos. Listen to this very, very strange statement in Pirkei Avos. It says like this.
Where is it?
This is the second parak. Vehevei mechashei hefsed mitzvah keneged schoro. It's a very, very strange statement. All kinds of shocking, but the pshat, the simple pshat, is very difficult. When you do a mitzvah, think, hefsed mitzvah, what am I losing? Well, I'm losing money, it's costing me money, it's costing me time, effort, right? But can I get schoro? Look what I'm going to get. Right. Schar. Uschar avero. Whenever you're going to do an avero, think, fine, I'm going to do an avero. I'm going to work on Shabbos. I'm going to become richer. But can I get efsedo? Look what you're losing. You're losing olam haba. So always think of both sides. Why do I have to think of both sides? Yeah. Whenever I'm doing a mitzvah, think of the hefsed of the mitzvah. In other words, whenever I'm going to buy a pair of films, think about it. You know, it's costing you $500. It's a lot of money. But on the other hand, look at the merit that you're going to get. Why do the Chazal tell me that I have to weigh? Why should I weigh it all? Why shouldn't I say money? What's money? Can I get the schar? What's the idea of hevei mechashev hefsed mitzvah can I get for schar or can I get a seder? So In some of the Mefoshim, they say that this is talking to a specific person. Like a lot of the statements in Pirkei Avos are talking to a specific person with specific thoughts and with specific problems. This particular person that this statement in Pirkei Avos is talking to is a person with sfeikas. He has doubts. Right? He has doubts. Should I do a mitzvah or shouldn't I do a mitzvah? Why should he have doubts whether he should do the mitzvah or not? Because he's not a believer. He doesn't know, certainly, whether there was a Matan Torah or there was a God. He doesn't know. He thinks of that as a possibility. So now he has to figure out, is it worth it for me to give my life up to do mitzvahs, or isn't it worth it for me to give up my life to do mitzvahs? Meaning, If you're a 100% believer, if you have emuno shleimo, you don't have to be mechashev. There is no hefzed. You don't consider the hefzed at all. So obviously we are talking to a person who is not certain. Now, the analogy used is the following. Let's say, for instance, I would tell you, I want you, I have a perfect idea for an investment for you, right? You can invest $1,000, right? There is a 50-50 chance that you will make at the end of the year an extra $100, right? You know, so at the end of the year, you are going to get $1,100. But there is a 50-50 chance that you lose it all, right? Now, is that a good investment? Ridiculous. Of course, a terrible investment. Because, look, there is a 50-50 chance, right, that you may lose it all. And if you win, you only win $100. Right? In other words, the return doesn't cover for the chance. What about if I tell you a different case? I tell you like this. You have an extra $1,000. Good, invest it with me. There is a 50-50 chance that you are going to get, or even more, let's change it. There is a 20% chance that from the $1,000 you're going to make $1,000,000 at the end of the year. You hear, you're going to become a millionaire with $1,000. There is a 20% chance or a 10% chance you'll become a millionaire. But there is a 90 or an 80% chance you may lose it all. Right? Assuming you can afford the $1,000, is that a good investment or not? It's an excellent investment. It's an excellent investment. I would do it all the time. Why? Because obviously the return overweighs the chance. You understand what I mean? That the return overweighs the chance. Meaning, the return of $100 is not sufficient to overweigh the chance of 50-50. But the return of $1,000,000, right, definitely overturns even the chance of 10 out of 100. Do you understand the logic behind it? Because there's such a thing as chance and a return. Small return, right, I won't take a chance. For a large return, I will take a chance.
That's risk-reward ratio.
Exactly. That's what they call it, the risk-reward ratio. There has to be a logical risk-reward ratio. Now, if the reward is sufficient, I will be willing to take a larger risk. Right? That is the idea behind it. Then it's a purely logical idea. Now, if a person is considering, should I accept Judaism or shouldn't I accept Judaism? That's his choice, right? Here's his choice. And you say, well, you have to be certain in order to accept Judaism. Not at all. This is what the Mishnah is telling you. You can base your commitment to Judaism on doubt, on uncertainty. You can be uncertain and it's still 100% logical for you to become a committed Jew. How? With the same example as the investment. Right? Let's assume that a person gave up his life to do mitzvahs. He became a religious Jew. And he comes to the world to come. Right? And then he's laughed at. Why, come on, what a fool you were. Look what you lost. So many Shabbos you could have gone to the beach. It's all nonsense. It's all nonsense. So what did you lose? Right? So you lost, like the Mesilas Yeshurim says, right? So you lost 70 years, right? Assuming the best, right? That you could have had tremendous fun on Shabbos and you had to end up, you know, eating chont or in your house and going to shul, right? And you could have done who knows how many averes that you missed out. It's not so great. I mean, you know, Lemaise, it's not such a great world. You know, it doesn't give you that many pleasures. But even assuming the best life, right? So you missed out, right? So, Enochinami, you missed out and now you have nothing for it. But let's assume the other way around. Let's assume, right, that you make a choice not to become committed to Judaism, right? And then you are going to have tremendous pleasures. You're going to do all kinds of averes. You can eat in the best restaurants, right? And then at the end, you'll come to the next world, and then you'll be laughed at. You say, come on, you had a chance, and you didn't accept it. Then you are doomed eternally, right? Because you had the choice and you refused it, right? So that means that forever and ever and ever, right, you are going to have to pay the price for that choice.
So consider the risk-reward ratio, right? What does that tell you logically? That even if it's not right, you didn't lose so much, right? So you made an investment and you lost it, but look what you could have gained. Let's say you did commit yourself to Yiddishkeit, and it is emet, you'll have eternal reward. Isn't it kedai? Comes out that by pure risk-reward ratio, you can commit yourself to Yiddishkeit based on uncertainty. You don't need certainty to become a committed Jew. I just want to conclude that this is the pshat in the Mishnah. What does the Mishnah say? Have a mechashev hefsed mitzvah keneged schoro. What is the Mishnah telling you? What is the Mishnah telling you? If you have doubts, just consider, what is the hefsed of the mitzvah? I'm going to do so many pleasures, right? So many shabbosim that I could have gone to the beach. But look at the reward ratio, right? Keneged schoro. Le'olam voed. Le'olam voed. You are going to be rewarded for the shabbos that you kept. Uschar aveiro. Oh. You went to a top restaurant, you had a tremendous pork chop. So you didn't have a tremendous pork chop. Look what you could have you could lose if you are wrong in Yiddishkeit is stuck a right, which means that you can make a commitment out of uncertainty. So that's why when you ask, but a logical person will accept it, it's 100% true. If he's really logical and honest, he will become a committed Jew out of uncertainty. Yeah.
What would you answer if somebody says, yeah, I hear the argument, it's very good, but the Christians, the Buddhists, the Zoroastrians,
right.
The Muslims,
that
everybody
is,
turns
yeah, right. This is why, I don't know if you noticed, but in the beginning, I told you, if a person has the following choice in front of him, either to accept or reject Yiddishkeit, that is the choice in front of him, right? In such a situation, this argument works, but you are 100% right. This is not an argument to convince somebody out of the blue that he has to become a religious Jew. It's only if that is the choice in front of him. Why? Because the counter argument is that every single ideology and religion in the world can give the same argument. Right? They can say, well, why should you take a chance? You don't follow us. And we say, follow us. And so, in the double self. Right? This is why I introduce the argument only in a situation when the person actually sees either one way or the other. In other words, it doesn't occur to him to become a Christian or a Muslim. It's either yes or not to accept Yiddishkeit. So then you have a very strong argument that even out of uncertainty, you have to accept Yiddishkeit. Now, yeah.
I want to offer a counter argument.
Yeah, go ahead.
First of all, in a sense, you're dealing with a sex thing. Because first the person has to believe the other side exists.
In other words, if you're 100% sure that it's wrong, then there is no argument. That's what you mean.
Right.
If you're 100% sure that it's wrong.
You know that Olam Haba is a fantasy.
Right.
So how am I going to believe it?
100%. 100%. But I want to tell you, I have never, as of now, I have never met an ideological certain atheist.